Welcome, everybody. One of my pleasanter duties as head of the economics department is to chair the annual BP lecture. And the department is very grateful to the BP company for providing us in recent years with a distinguished visiting professor. And each year, the professor appointed gives this lecture. I would like to welcome Peter Davis, chief economist at BP, and his colleagues from BP who are here this evening. This year, the BP visiting professor is Professor Debrage Ray from NYU. Professor Debrage Ray received his BA in economics from Presidency College in Calcutta in 1977, and his MA and PhD in economics from Cornell University. He has distinguished himself over the years in areas of economics ranging from microeconomic theory through to the economics of development. His many honors and awards include Fellowship of the Econometric Society in 1993, John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship in 1997, the Mahalanobis Memorial Medal of the Indian Econometric Society in 1989, and the Medal of the Indian National Science Academy in 1988. It is a great pleasure to the department to have him visiting with us this year, and I'm delighted to introduce his lecture, Polarization and Conflict. The floor is yours.
Thanks a lot. Okay, I guess you can hear me, right? Is that at the back? Okay. So I just want to say how very grateful I am, very happy to be here, even though John Sutton revealed the date of my BA degree, which my white hair reveals it too, I guess, so it's not so bad. And I'm particularly grateful to BP for making my 1 year stay here possible. I had a wonderful time. I taught an undergraduate course. I taught a PhD course. Some of my undergraduate students are here. I can see them, so I'm very grateful they're here as well. So thank you, BP, for making all of this possible. And in fact, I thought I'd talk about oil and conflict, the case of Africa, but then I didn't want to insult my my hosts, so I will refrain from that topic. So I've chosen the somewhat more... somewhat safer topic of polarization and conflict, which focuses on a certain on a different aspect to conflict around the world. Now, this talk actually is a bit of a theoretical lecture. It's a lecture on the concept of polarization, how it's defined, what it means, and so forth. But I wanted to put it in an ambient surrounding of an application. So I thought. One recent application of this concept has been to thinking about the determinants of civil war. So I'm going to focus on that as well. In fact, more than 50% of my talk will be on that subject. So this is really not an outline of the talk because I'm going to start a little bit by talking about conflict. And then I'm going to go to the concept of polarization, and I'm going to show you how that might have a very useful application to the kind of statistical studies that people have been doing in the area of civil war. Okay, most of the conceptual work that I'm going to talk about is my own work jointly done with Joan Esteban at Barcelona, and a lot of the empirical work that I'll be talking about is the work of Jose Montalvo and Marta Reynal Quiroral. I think Marta was an LSE PhD student at one point, so I think that that fits the bill very nicely. Okay, so let me tell you stuff that you probably already know, but just to sort of set the background, if you look at the period after the Second World War, it's between 1945 and the turn of the century, if you look at the number of wars that have been fought since then, wars between countries, right? There have been approximately 25 of them. I won't be able to enumerate all of them standing right here, but there have been about 25 of them. And they've resulted in around between three and three and a half million deaths. Right? In contrast, if you look at the deaths in civil wars during the same period, okay, the total comes to over 16 million. Okay? And you know, the 16 million figure is not counting, of course, the large amounts of refugee movements and the consequent deaths that have taken place because of illness or malnutrition or starvation. This is a sort of a baseline estimate. Okay? So you can see that at least after 1945, up to the present, the real dominant form of conflict really has been within boundaries, not across boundaries. Okay? And there's been civil wars in 73 states, so just to give you an idea, with a median duration of 6 years. And in fact, at the end of the century, there were still about 25 of them ongoing. So civil wars are clearly symptomatic of ongoing unrest and violence around the world. The problem, of course, with civil war is that it does not even begin to capture you know, the day-to-day kind of violence or organized social protest, demonstrations and processions that you see in developing countries everywhere, but at least it is one stark and rather extreme symbol of it. Okay. Now, the focus on my talk today, apart from civil war, and this is the second aspect here, is the notion of ethnicity or ethnic divisions. Okay. Now, it's been argued, and it's been argued quite forcefully, actually, that ethnic divisions may be the significant determinant of conflict. And I'm going to have a lot to say about the notion of not just ethnicity, but exactly how it might affect conflict. But let me just start first with this overall statement. And in fact, writers such as Samuel Huntington have been extremely vocal in making the argument that one should look at war or violence within societies as a cultural phenomenon. Okay. Now, the main reason why this argument is made is essentially that ethnicity as a concept is far less mutable than ideology or economic differences or even nationality. Okay. So the idea is that, you know, you're born with your ethnicity, and this is the stuff that really drives things. So, for example, here's a person I'm going to quote again and again because I'm a real admirer of his book, and I really recommend that you read it. This is the work of Donald Horowitz. This is actually from the second edition of his book in the year 2000, but I'm quoting from the 1985 version. So he writes, "The Marxian concept of class as an inherited and determinative affiliation finds no support in the data. Marx's conception applies with far less distortion to ethnic groups. Ethnic membership is generally given at birth and have considerable power to generate conflict. So in much of Asia and Africa, it is only modest hyperbole to assert that the Marxian prophecy has had an ethnic fulfillment," okay, which is a very provocative line, right? Especially for an economist, yeah? Because, you know, economists, you know, tend to see everything in terms of economic differences or economic antagonisms. And here is somebody else making a completely different argument, saying that the class structure is not what drives it, it's really ethnic structure. Now, of course, an economist, while faced with this sort of assertion, wouldn't back away entirely, okay? And one could still argue that ethnicity is not necessarily a primordial or an intrinsic source of conflict, okay? Just because, for example, just because I'm Hutu and you're Tutsi, just this fact may not be conflictual in itself, but there may be other economic forces around, and then ethnicity plays an important role, okay, in feeding off that economic scarcity, right? So, in short, ethnicity may be a marker for carving out a larger share of a given pie, right? Now, what I'm going to talk about today is going to be largely silent on this, but I'm at least going to end with some comments on this particular issue. Okay. So, the primordial instrumental issue is an important one, no doubt, but there's a more basic question that needs to be settled first. Okay? And the more basic question is it really true that ethnic divisions matter for conflict? Okay? Now, I don't know what the statement "really true" exactly means, okay, because different disciplines interpret that in very different ways. Okay? But I guess I can see two ways to approach this sort of question. Right? The first would be to do a careful sociological, anthropological, economic, historical study of conflicts one by one. And this is really the subject of Horowitz's masterpiece, okay? Which, you know, it's a very careful study of different kinds of conflicts that you see largely in Africa and parts of Asia. Okay? But the problem is with this sort of study is that there's a bit of a wood for the trees problem, right? Which is that you're seeing such a dazzling variety of different things going on. It's very hard to tell exactly what is driving which, what's fundamental, what's not, or even all the interactions. Even assuming that everything is endogenous, just understanding the interrelations is a harder problem. So the alternative, and that's something that economists tend to take to a little better, though even though it's drier, right, is, and also it relies on a little more lack of knowledge, as in my case, right, is the statistical study, which is essentially run regressions of things to the extent that you can find data. Okay. Now, I view these as complementary. I mean, I get as big a kick or even bigger out of reading Horowitz than of reading the studies over here, which I cite here, Collier, Hoffler, Furen, Leighton, and many others. Okay. But it's really the statistical part that I'm going to try and get a handle on today. So here are the typical variables that people put in a test. Okay. So there are many measures of conflict, obviously, ranging all the way from the incidence of demonstration processions or strikes and so on. Okay. And even with the special choice of civil war, there are all sorts of defining criteria. In fact, once you open this box, okay, of trying to understand how people define variables, what they do with them, it's bound to give anybody nightmares, at least it did to me. You know, it's very hard to figure out exactly what's going on. Right? So even with the defining criteria for civil war, there's all a large amount of literature, okay? And I've just referred to some of that. And I'll tell you a little bit more later on if that's necessary. So what one does with this is take, in this particular case, civil war, okay, or the onset of civil war, and throw that onto the left-hand side of a regression, okay? And then on the right-hand side, there's a bunch of explanatory variables, okay? So the typical kind of the typical fight is set up between ethnicity and economics, right? So on this side of the ring, we have the economic variables, okay? Per capita income, inequality of income, resource holdings, whether the country is an oil exporter, for example. These sorts of matters go into the economic variables. Then there are geographical variables. Is the place mountainous or not? You know, I mean, that can have a big effect on whether there is guerrilla activity, for example. Separation from the capital city and so on. Then there are political variables, okay? And of course, there's the famous ethnic variable, okay, and on which I'm going to have a bit more to say today. Okay, so there's a bunch of sources to actually put down, to construct measures of ethno-linguistic diversity, okay? The World Christian Encyclopedia is actually a particularly good source. But this can be supplanted by various others, including the Atlas Narodov Mira from the now defunct Soviet Union, which in 1964 published this incredible study of ethno-linguistic families around the world. Okay. On matters of religious diversity, the World Christian Encyclopedia is a bit more problematic, okay, because it tends to overstate the number of Christians. Okay. But nevertheless, there are other sources which are used. Okay. So and then, once you have these notions of diversity, you take an index of ethnic diversity, you construct an index, and the index that is constructed is the famous index, which has been used in a variety of studies, is what is called the ethno-linguistic fractionalization index. Okay? Now, this is a mouthful for a rather simple concept, and it is important for me because for the theory of what I'm going to talk about is that I get a little bit more into this concept. Okay? By the way, notice that just because it's called the ethno-linguistic fractionalization index, that doesn't mean that you can't use it for religion as well. You can construct the religious fractionalization index as well. So the important thing is to understand what it is, right? So the idea of the ethno-linguistic fractionalization index is simply this. If you take two people at random, from a population, what's the probability that they'll belong to two different ethnic groups? Okay, so for example, if there are M groups and NJ is the population share of group J, right? Then the probability that I pick someone from group J is NJ, and then the probability that the second person I pick is from a different group is 1 minus NJ, right? And then I add the whole stuff up, right? And that gives me an idea of the average probability that two people randomly selected will come from different groups. Okay? So that's the ethno-linguistic fractionalization index. Now, it's very trivial to rewrite this as just thinking of it, and this is another way I want you to think of it for a moment, as the share of group J multiplied by the population share of group K times the distance between these two groups. Okay? Now, the word distance in the case of ethnic groups is very simple. It's just 0, 1. Okay? If the distance is 1, if the two groups are distinct, and the distance is 0 otherwise. So that's what's hidden under the ethno-linguistic fractionalization index. That what you do is you look at the average distances across groups, where the distance is just a basic 0-1 variable. Okay? And this, for this reason, it's very closely related to the Gini inequality measure, and I'm going to come back to that later on. So anyway, ELF, for short, okay, is widely used in empirical work. Okay, and that's, here's a list of references, just to give you an idea of the work that goes on here. Okay, but the interesting thing, and now comes the punchline of this sort of literature, is that it shows no correlation with conflict. Well, that's not exactly correct. It shows no correlation with conflict when the other economic variables, including per capita income and so forth, have been appropriately controlled for. So in a multivariate regression where you put in per capita income and the other stuff, then ELF has no power, okay? Has no correlative power with the onset of conflict. And there's a bunch of papers that attempt to show that. Okay. So here's a quote from one of the recent papers published in the American Political Science Review a couple of years ago. So Fearon and Layton say that the estimates for the effect of ethnic and religious fractionalization are substantively and statistically insignificant. The empirical pattern is thus inconsistent with the common expectation that ethnic diversity is a major and direct cause of civil violence. Right? And in contrast, they go on to say, per capita income, now these are political scientists, not economists, I should add, but still nevertheless, in contrast, per capita income measured as thousands of 1985 US dollars is strongly significant in both a statistical and a substantive sense. Okay. Now, there are obvious issues of endogeneity. I mean, just as per capita income can cause conflict, conflict can cause per capita income to come down, and these sorts of corrections have been made in more recent work using, for example, rainfall as an instrument. But let me leave those details out. Okay. Now, so this is where the matter, sort of the state of the art stood at the end of 2004, okay, from the statistical angle. That there's a lot of talk about ethnic diversity being a predictor of war, but it's not there in the data. Okay. Now, of course, this is not to say that ethnic or religious fractionalization mightn't indirectly affect conflict. Okay, it could, right? So, for example, it could reduce GDP, right? So, fractionalization could, and in fact, there's some evidence for this in the work of Alberto Alesina, for example, who argues that fractionalized societies are more likely to have lower GDP. Or it could lower the growth rate of GDP, and this argument has been made by Easterly and Levine. Okay, or it could create poor governance, and there's work by Mauro on this. And then via these channels, it could then go back and affect conflict. Okay, just for example, as we saw, per capita income was important, right? But the point is that there is no direct effect. That fractionalization per se, ethnic diversity per se, has no direct impact on conflict. Now, what I want to ask today is the question of whether ELF is the right measure, okay? And I want to tax your patience a little bit by talking for a few minutes about this issue, okay? And I'm going to go into a fair amount of detail on this question, but I'm not going to get overly statistical about it. Okay, so here's Horowitz again. He writes, okay, so I have intimated, it's almost as if he's upset with these results. Of course, he's writing in 1985, a few years before. I have intimated at various points that a system with only two ethnic parties is especially conflict-prone. In dispersed systems, group loyalties are parochial and ethnic conflict is localized. It could put one of a series of watertight compartments out of order, but it could not make the ship of state sink. Nice language there. The demands of one group can sometimes be granted without injuring the interests of others. But then he goes on to say, on the other hand, a centrally focused system with few groupings possesses fewer cleavages than a dispersed system, but those it possesses runs through the whole society and are of greater magnitude. And when conflict occurs, the center has little latitude to placate some groups without antagonizing others. So as you might imagine, this notion of broad cleavages having a lot of conflict power, as opposed to a myriad of different groups, fractionalized groups. But the idea of there being two sort of groups facing off or a small number of groups is, of course, an older theme, right? So there's the old Marxian theme. I just wanted to quote it back to you, except done couched in terms of class rather than caste or ethnicity, right? As the struggle proceeds, the whole society breaks up more and more into two hostile camps, bourgeoisie and proletariat. The classes polarize so that they become internally more homogeneous and more sharply distinguished from one another in wealth and power. Okay, so now we are getting to the other part of the title of this talk, which is to think about this notion of polarization a little bit more. Now, the point is, what I'm going to try and argue now, that this notion of polarization, which of course we haven't really formalized yet, we haven't conceptualized fully yet, this is different from the notion of fragmentation which these political scientists and economists are putting into the right-hand side of that regression. Okay, and I want to try and make that point a little bit more strongly. Okay, so as I said, this is more a notion of polarization than of fragmentation, and so now I want to move to the sort of the core part, the second part of my talk, which is to tell you a little bit about how one might go towards constructing an alternative measure, okay, which is different from the ELF index. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is based on work with Joan Esteban. Actually, the first paper we wrote on this was in 1994, so it was a little bit before all of this became fashionable. Okay, in other words, the correlates with war became fashionable, but now it seems that it could have some application. Okay, so now put on your theoretical hats for a second. Okay. And imagine that society is divided into different groups. So let's start from first principles, okay? Economic, social, religious, spatial, whatever. And I want you to think of a situation where there is the notion of identity, so that there is homogeneity within each group. But there is also the coexisting notion of alienation, okay? That there is heterogeneity across groups. Okay? And I want to show you a set of axioms which are going to presume that such a situation, the coexistence of strong feelings of identity coupled with strong feelings of alienation towards the other, is inherently conflictual. Okay? Now, this is not going to be something that I'm going to be able to deduce. This is only something that I'm going to be able to assume. Okay? And then I want to show you what sort of measures come out from this identity alienation framework. Okay? Now, I always wanted to reach the age where I could quote from myself, okay? And if you will just permit me the luxury of one quote, this is what Juan and I wrote in 1994 when we actually wrote the first version of this paper. So we begin with the obvious question, why are we interested in polarization? And we wrote, it is our contention that the phenomenon of polarization is closely linked to the generation of tensions, to the possibilities of articulated rebellion and revolt, and to the existence of social unrest in general. Okay, so this was something that we did have in mind, and so let's see where it takes us. Okay, so take the standard theory of inequality measurement, of which ELF is a part, right? Because it's like the Gini index. So does it fit this particular bill, right, of identity alienation? So let me draw you a little example. Okay, but before I do that, let me just tell you something for those of you who may not know about how inequality measurement works. The entire core of this literature is based on one fundamental assumption, which is called the Pigou-Dalton transfers principle. Okay? Now, this rather lovely sounding phrase actually has a very simple meaning, which says that if you're doing measurement, and if you transfer income or wealth from a relatively poor person to a relatively rich person, then all measures of inequality should go up. Okay, so the underlying principle, this underlying principle is behind all of the theory of inequality measurement. Okay, so hold on to that for just a few seconds while I show you the following diagram. So what I've drawn for you here is a distribution of income. Okay, so a standard density function. Now, what I want to do to this distribution of income is I want to compress it. So the blue line is a kind of compressed distribution, but locally compressed. But here, I want to create the idea that two groups are forming. Okay, so I want to capture the idea that at sort of at the lower end, there is a group which is more identified with one another, okay, because their incomes are closer. At the upper end, there's another group which is also identified with each other. And the two feel a more distinct difference from each other. Okay? Now, I'm not pushing this one way or the other, but it is reasonable to entertain that the second situation, okay, could be much more conflictual than the first, potentially, simply because there's a better notion of class in the second situation relative to the first. I'm not asking you to accept that entirely. I'm just asking you to entertain that possibility. Okay? But the point is that if you do so, then you've had it with the Pigou-Dalton principle, because in this picture, every transfer of income is from a relatively rich person to a relatively poor person. Okay? So it's not that this picture should push you necessarily one way or the other, but the point is that the Pigou-Dalton principle of necessity excludes this as saying that this is more conflictual. Okay? It will say that this distribution of income is more equal. Okay? That follows from the Pigou-Dalton principle. Okay, now I want you to show another, I want you to see another picture. Okay, so this was this one. But this is, of course, not to suggest that polarization is always different from inequality. I'm not making the argument that it's always different. Here is another picture, here's another distribution. Think of it as one of the sort of humps that you saw earlier, where you were, or now imagine that this is the entire distribution, and just compress this one. Okay, so there isn't a double compression, just one compression in the entire distribution. Then it would be reasonable to argue that both polarization has come down and inequality has come down. Okay? So I'm not trying to make the argument that the things are always against each other, but there are some cases in which they go hand in hand and other cases where they don't. Yeah? But notice that notice something very interesting about the examples, about the two examples, or at least that I found interesting, is that in both cases, the type of transfer, okay, the type of squeeze or compression of the distribution, okay, was the same, right? Except that in the first example, there were two of them, and in the second example, there was one of them, okay? But the effects, the intuitive effects are different, okay? And what I want to try and say is, therefore, no local criterion, like the Pigou-Dalton principle, which just says transfer income from poor to rich, period, inequality will go up. That's a local criterion. It doesn't take into account the overall picture of the situation, right? So no local criterion can capture this. So what I want to do then for the next few minutes is to tell you a little bit about how one might begin to capture this particular sort of concept, okay, the idea of polarization. Okay. Well, I've said this before. Observe that the notion of groups here may be quite general, economic, social, and so forth, but concentrate on the last line of that slide. I just want to say that economic groupings have a very natural notion of distance, and that makes it an easier starting point. So let me start with that, and then I'll make the translation to non-economic groupings. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about how to approach polarization for economic groupings. Okay. So here's the way the axiomatic approach works. Okay. You start with various distributions of income. So that's the inputs into a machine. Okay. And then what the polarization measure on an inequality measure or any kind of measure does is that it spits out these outputs, which it says this distribution is polarized, let's say 0.8, that one's 0.9. The numbers itself have no meaning. Okay, what's important really are the rankings. Okay, that it spits out a particular kind of answer. Right. So what we want to do is we want to put restrictions on this machine to see that we find are intuitive. Okay, so that's the idea of the axiomatic approach. So the objective now is to axiomatically try and pin down a class of measures. Okay, so let me go back to this idea of identity versus alienation. Okay, so the basic starting point is that each individual feels two sorts of things. Okay, one is she feels identification with people who are similar to her. Okay, similar income. And for this, for those of you a little bit more technically minded, I'm going to use as a proxy the height of the density, okay, of the income distribution, which I call N of X at income X. Okay. And then she feels alienation from people who are far away from her. Okay. And for that, I use as a proxy the income distance between a person at income X and a person at income Y. Okay. And the starting point, which is what I would like to impress upon you, is that the effective antagonism, okay, this is just a term that I've coined just to make the point here, the effective antagonism of X towards Y does not just depend on the alienation she feels, but also on the identification that she feels. Okay? So we are not talking about somebody who feels so alienated from society that this isolated individual goes out, buys a machine gun, and shoots a bunch of people down. Okay? I want to think about notions of organized protest or social rebellion or social demonstrations, processions, whatever. So that's why you may feel antagonism towards another person, but that antagonism can only have power if you can actually identify with a bunch of people who feel the same way. Okay? So I want to write that as saying that the effective antagonism of X towards Y depends on X's alienation from Y, of course, okay, but also on X's sense of identification. So again, for those of you a little bit formally minded, you want to write down the effective antagonism of X towards Y really as a function, let's call it T, okay, where in the domain of that function are two things. I, the amount of identification that the person feels, and A, the amount of alienation that that person feels. Okay, so I is the density here, and A is the income difference. Right? And I want to think of polarization as the sum of all such antagonisms in society. Okay, so all I've done is added up all these antagonisms, okay? In formal terms, I've integrated. Now, this is not very useful at all, okay? This is just, this really has no more content than the few sentences that I just spoke, right? Which is that people feel sort of effective antagonism, and then I want to think of polarization as the sum of all of that. The reason why it has very little meaning or very little content is that this T function is completely unspecified. Okay, so you can have your T function and I can have mine, and we can both construct different measures from it. Okay, so we have to go a little bit further. Okay. And here's the way we go a little bit further. So what I want to do now is I want to now create intuitive scenarios and ask myself, would polarization go up here or go down here? Okay, and these intuitive scenarios I'm going to call axioms. Okay. And I'm going to look at very, very special situations, okay? Scenarios where all distributions, all the income distributions, are built out of very simple basic building blocks, which I'll call basic densities, okay? Which look like this. Very, very simple. So I'm not putting in any kind of extra stuff that I don't know much about. And I'm going to place the axioms on these densities on a very restricted class, and then try to extend it to thinking about a measure for all conceivable income distributions. Okay, so let me run through the axioms that I write down. Okay, so the first axiom that I write down is that if a distribution is just a single basic density, if the entire income distribution is just a single basic density, then if I globally compress it, okay, polarization cannot go up. Okay, so what I mean in terms of the picture is that here's a basic density, and then I squeeze it, okay, and what I've written down in the at the bottom of that is the appropriate mathematical way. This is sort of explain why we do it in this particular way. But we squeeze it completely symmetrically. Then we want to argue that polarization in this case should not come down. The second axiom states that if a symmetric distribution happens to be composed of three different scalings of the same basic density, this is what it looks like, okay? Then if I compress the two side densities, the two on the side like this, okay, then polarization cannot go down. Okay, so in the first case, I say that this in the squeeze, polarization cannot go up. In the second case, I say polarization cannot go down. Okay, now you might say, why on earth is Devraj using such special densities? We never observe these things in real life. So what's the point of these axioms, right? And the answer is, the point is that the more special are these densities, okay, the less restrictive my axioms are. Okay, because I'm imposing them in only very, very special cases where we can understand very cleanly what the problem is all about. Okay? So the more special it is, the better it is for me. Okay? So the second axiom states this. So it captures that double squeeze effect I told you about earlier. The third axiom says, suppose that there's a symmetric distribution which has four scalings of the same basic density. Okay? And I take the two in the middle and I slide them apart. Then polarization goes up. And my last axiom says that population size doesn't matter. Okay, if I scale population up and down, it doesn't matter. So these are the four axioms I want to write down. Now it turns out that under these four axioms, okay, a polarization measure has to look the way I've put it up over there. It's if and only if. So if it satisfies it, it satisfies those four axioms. If it satisfies those four axioms, it has to be this one. Okay? And it looks like this. What you do, just pictorially for a second, look at it and remove that alpha term that you see over there. Then it's exactly the Gini coefficient. Okay? Now put the alpha back, okay, because I want it back there, because I want to argue that it's different. And the construction says the theorem says that the polarization measure has to have not just densities in them, but densities raised to a particular power. Okay? And that's where the identification is coming from, the idea of identification, that if you have people there, if you have people around you, that creates more than proportional weight. Okay? So that's the kind of intuition over there. Okay. So now what I've tried to show you from the sort of theoretical part is that we actually generate a particular class of measures from it. Okay? In fact, I've written down the genie there for you at the bottom, and you can see the parallel. Okay, it looks only slightly different, okay, because of that alpha, but that makes a huge difference. So let me try to explain in what way. Okay, so it's this alpha that makes all the difference. So just to give you an idea of how this measure works, is that unlike inequality, polarization is actually maximized for bimodal distributions. Okay, so it has this sort of cleavages property that Horowitz and others have talked about. The second point, which is something that I alluded to earlier, is that polarization has this contextual property. So for example, if I were to take two big groups like this, right, and merge them together, and the third group is tiny, then my polarization measure would actually come down, as it should. Okay. But if I take another picture where exactly the same qualitative description, except the tiny group isn't tiny anymore, it's large, right? And then you merge the other two groups, then you have a standoff between two groups, and polarization actually goes up. Okay? So this measure behaves contextually in different ways, right, depending on the sizes of groups involved. And similarly, okay, so let me, you know, again, there is this issue. For example, if I take two groups like this, move them apart, of course polarization goes up. But on the way, as I move them apart, this is the middle picture, as they're going apart, I'm moving population from the middle to the sides, polarization may actually come down because it's more fragmented. Okay, so it has this sort of properties. Okay, now I'm going to go back to Civil War in the next 5 minutes. Okay, but before I do that, I want to say a little bit more about alpha to pin this thing down a little bit more. So as I said, there are restrictions which come from the axioms. Don't ask me why the restrictions are between a quarter and a one. Okay, I can explain if anybody's interested. Okay, but in many cases, the measure can be narrowed even further, right? And this measure can be narrowed from various directions, and we've tried doing it from various directions, partly using a behavioral model, partly using further axiomatics, and obviously I don't have the time to talk about all of that. So here is one example, okay? So here's an axiomatic way to narrow it, okay? Which is this. Suppose you have the following picture. You have a tiny group, which I'm calling R, that's the population size of R, okay? And we have a group that's of size P, and another group that's of size Q, and P is actually a little bigger than Q, okay? Then I want, this is what the axiom states, okay? The axiom states that if I move mass from that tiny R group, and I build up identification in the slightly less small of the two large groups, right, then polarization should not come down. Now, you might ask, why didn't I put this axiom up before? Okay. And the reason is that I'm not entirely sure of this axiom. Okay, it's plausible, it's possible, okay, and I can debate this over coffee if you like, but it doesn't have the same compelling power of the other four. Okay. But I wanted to put it up, I want to show you that this is another possible way to approach it. Okay. So if, suppose we added on this axiom, okay, then actually alpha must be one. Okay. Then a measure satisfies the five axioms that I've written down, if and only if it looks like the way I put it up there. Okay. Now, I'm not, again, not pushing it entirely, but pushing it part of the way. I want to take this as a convenient starting point and go back to the Civil War questions with it. Okay, now, notice that this sort of polarization measure can be easily applied not just to income groupings, but also to ethno-linguistic or religious groupings, right? And this is what it would look like, right? So suppose that you had M different social groups based on region, kin, ethnicity, religion, whatever, right? And then again, remember that NJ is the share of group J, okay? Then an index of pure social polarization, as it were, so now the distances would be back to being 1 or 0, okay, would have the property that instead of adding up the distances across groups weighted by the population shares of the groups, you'd weight it by the square of the population share on one group and the population share of the other. Now, that looks asymmetric. Why should K being treated differently from J? And the answer is it's not, because somewhere else in the sum, K will be the J and J will be the K, and then it'll get its square term as well. So there's no asymmetry here, okay? So you just add the whole thing up in this particular way, okay? So that looks very much like ELF, except, so it looks like the probability that two people will be chosen, will be coming from different populations, except there's a square, okay, on the J term. And this is the measure that's used by Jose Montalvo and Marta Reynal in their AER forthcoming paper. And I want, in the time that I have left, I want to talk a little bit about their paper, okay, to show you how we can revisit the Fearon-Leighton Collier-Hoffler question with this particular measure. Okay. So just to fix ideas, this is the measure of polarization that I have in mind. And this is the measure of fragmentation that we talked about earlier. Okay. So there's a 2 instead of a 1, and that makes a difference. Okay. So, for instance, if all groups are of equal size, okay, so just theoretically now, not even getting into the data, if all groups are of equal size, what will happen to that polarization measure that I just wrote down? This polarization measure would reach a maximum at 2 groups and then decline thereafter, if all groups were of equal size. What would happen to the fragmentation measure that I wrote down? This fragmentation measure would increase throughout as the number of groups increases. Okay, so these would be very different. That's what I've written here. Okay, but the point is that it also matters empirically. Okay, so that's fine. You know, theoretically it's fine. But here's the as Montalvo and Marta Reynal show, it also matters empirically. And here is a little graph where I'm sorry I couldn't make the font size bigger. I just lifted it off their paper. Marta and Jose have ethnic polarization on the x-axis, and they have ethnic fractionalization on the y-axis. And this is what it looks like actually from the data. Okay? So you can see that at very low levels of polarization, there is a very high correlation between polarization and fragmentation. So imagine, for example, that there is only one dominant group. Okay? Then fractionalization would be low and polarization would be low. Okay? But then as the number of groups starts to increase and you have different population compositions, then it starts going all over the place. Okay? So, you know, there are examples. For example, Guatemala and Sierra Leone, for example, are examples of countries where ethnic polarization is high. So, for example, in Guatemala, you know, half the population is Ladino, what they call mestizo, right? And the other half is Mayan, okay? And this makes for a high amount of ethnic polarization, but of course a very low amount of fragmentation, okay? Nigeria or Bosnia are examples of countries where religious polarization is high, but religious fractionalization is low. Okay, so for example, Nigeria will have mainly Christians and Muslims. Right. Okay, so let me continue to discuss now Montalvo and Reynal Querol a little bit further. Okay, so what they're going to do is they're going to run the following race. Right, the race is going to be between ethnic fractionalization and ethnic polarization, as well as between religious fractionalization and religious polarization, okay? And I want to try and, you know, I don't want to sell you this as just some kind of statistical exercise. I want to show you that this may have some meaning because, precisely because of the earlier findings that ethnic diversity has no connection with war. So what they do is they take the same specification as Fearon-Leighton, okay, but this time using polarization indices. So let me say a little bit more about the data, okay? I have the time to do so. So there are about 138 countries. The dependent variable is the incidence of a civil war over the next 5 years. So it's what we're going to do is run a logit, okay? So the chance of having a war, the odds ratio of having a war in the next 5 years. There's a definition of civil war, which has to do with 1,000 deaths and so forth. We can talk about that in the question and answer session. Yeah? And then the usual suspects, right, on the explanatory variables. Per capita income, population size, terrain, primary exports, democracy indicators, and of course, indices of ethnic or religious polarization. Okay? So first let me run a logit of war on ethnic fractionalization. So I'm going to just, I'm going to show you a little bit of the Fearon-Leighton analysis as replicated by Reynal and Montalvo in a little bit more detail, just to give you an idea of how it works, okay? So here's the simplest logit you can run, okay? Incidence of civil war on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, you have ethnic fractionalization and per capita GDP, okay? The red stuff is significant, okay? So you see that ethnic fractionalization has a positive effect on civil war, okay, on the incidence of civil war. But as soon as you start putting in other variables, this positive effect goes away, okay? So, for example, if you put in the population size, that's the end of ethnic fractionalization, okay? Per capita income continues to be significant, right? If you put in primary exports, it stays insignificant. And if you start putting in mountains, non-contiguous state capitals, democracy indicators, it's gone. Okay, it never comes back, right? Now run it with ethnic polarization. Okay, here's the basic stuff again. It's positively related to civil war. Okay, now we put in exactly the same variables as we put in before, right? Population, it stays significant. Okay, primary exports, it stays significant. And then we put in the whole lot, right? Mountains and non-contiguous and democracy, it stays significant, okay? So it seems that statistically, at least ethnic polarization seems to have some positive and significant effect on civil war, whereas fractionalization does not. Okay. Now, this effect, by the way, is not just significant, it's pretty big, okay? So for example, if you were to raise the level of ethnic polarization from the average in the sample, these numbers should mean nothing to you, okay, and it's not important, okay? But if you raise it from the average in the sample to that of, let's say, Nigeria, okay, then the predicted probability of a war doubles, okay? So it's a pretty big effect. Okay? So, or more conservatively, if you increase the level by one standard deviation, it raises conflict probability by about 50%. Okay. Now, when you try the same logit with religious variables, you get a very similar effect. So let me just sort of skim through very quickly for you. Okay. Again, religious fractionalization is positively affects civil war, okay, when you just put in per capita GDP. But then out it goes, okay? When you put in the other variables, then it doesn't come back. Religious polarization performs better, but not as well as ethnic polarization did. Let me show you what the data looks like. Okay, again, it starts off positively when you have the simple regression, and then it loses significance as you start putting in other variables. But when you put in the full set of controls, it's significant. Okay, so religious polarization does seem to significantly and positively affect the probability of civil war if you have the full set of controls. I'll say a little bit more about this if I have the time later on. Now, what's nice about the Marta Reynal's paper is that she and Jose Montalvo actually provide an entire battery of different robustness checks, okay, which I'm not going to bore you with, okay. But for example, if you enter ethnic polarization into the same regression with ethnic fractionalization. Into the same regression, the former is significant, the latter is not. And it's the same is true if you try another measure of ethnic dominance. These observations are still true if ethnic is replaced by religious. Now, here on religious, there's something interesting. If you look at column three, for example, where you enter religious polarization and religious fractionalization together, okay. Then it turns out that religious polarization then has a very large and positive significant effect, and religious fractionalization is also significant but negative. Okay? So there is a very interesting discussion in the paper about how when you really put them all into the same equation, fractionalization, if anything, tends to bring conflict down rather than to bring it up. Okay? But that's an aside on which I don't have the time to go into further. Okay. And then, you know, they try different data sets, different classifications. Okay. So I think I made the point, and I want to now go on. They also try other indices of ethnic and religious polarization, alternative definitions of civil war, pure cross-section logits, so forth. The effect does not go away. Okay. Okay. So I am going to end in the next 5 minutes or so, but I want to end by, because I'm a theorist, okay, my interest is in how this stuff also feeds back into my thinking about these problems, okay? So the this conflict application actually feeds back for me into questions about theory, okay? And this is actually, in a way, related to the old question of, is ethnicity primordial or instrumental as a source of conflict? These analyses, I will emphasize, do not address that question, right? The findings on per capita income certainly support an instrumentalist position, okay, that per capita income is negatively related, but certainly the ethnic variable itself doesn't tell us much. Now, here's one way to do that, okay, one test. Try and see if economic differences across ethnic groups predicts conflict. Okay, so on top of conflict, try and put in the average per capita income of group A and the average the per capita income of group B, and see if a widening of that per capita income creates conflict. Right, that seems like a natural thing to try. There are some problems with that test. Okay, one reason, there are two reasons really. So one reason is that it's hard to get data. Okay, but data is something that we'll get over the next 10 years or so. I mean, there's much more data now than there's ever been before, and this is going to go on increasing. But there is a problem now. At the moment, there's lack of data. Okay? But the second reason, and that's what I want to sort of finish with today, is the second reason is really far more fundamental. Okay? And for that, I want you to think about two kinds of economic conflict that might actually occur across ethnic groups. Okay. And I'll broadly call them vertical and horizontal. Okay? So a vertical war is when ethnic classifications are more or less aligned with class classifications, so it's really a war of poor versus rich. Okay? And such a war certainly exists. It's not that it doesn't exist. I'll give you some examples. Hutu-Tutsi in Rwanda and Burundi, the caste wars in Bihar, Bengalis in pre-Bangladesh-Pakistan, or Muslims in the Philippines, the Kurds in Iraq, the Sikhs in the Punjab, even though the Sikhs were not the poorer group, okay, but still, nevertheless, there's a class element there, right? The Naxalites in India, this is not ethnic, but this was a pure class war, right? So certainly there are elements of class war hidden inside ethnic conflict. But interestingly enough, more often than not, ethnic and religious conflicts are really horizontal, okay? And they're really attacks on competing businesses. They're ways of reducing labor supply, of the channeling of local public goods from one ethnic group to another. That's really the kind of war that's taking place. And for this, I want you to listen to Horowitz again. Okay? So he says, in study after study, it has been assumed that ethnic relations are necessary relations between superiors and subordinates. In fact, many ethnic groups are enmeshed in a system of subordination. But the relations of many other ethnic groups on a global scale, most ethnic groups are not accurately defined as superior-subordinate relations. Unlike ranked groups, which form part of a single society, unranked groups constitute incipient whole societies. It is not so much the politics of subordination that concerns them, but rather the politics of inclusion and exclusion. Okay? Sinhalese and Tamils in Sri Lanka, Malays and Chinese in Malaysia, Hausa Yoruba in Nigeria, Serbs Muslims in Bosnia, Dalits low-income Muslims in Gujarat, Basques and the others in Spain, and so forth. Okay, so there's a whole list one can write down. So the question then becomes, how do we augment our polarization measure, or if you don't like polarization measure, how do we augment just thinking theoretically about this, by bringing in wealth differences across groups? And what I want to suggest is that the answer may depend on the observer's feel for the sort of conflict that's relevant. For example, if it's vertical, then income differences across groups will very naturally be conducive to conflict, right? The more the difference, the more the conflict. And so will income homogeneity within groups, right? But if the conflict is horizontal, okay, then actually income or occupation similarities across groups, right, may drive conflict. So you'll have this peculiar situation where there's two ethnic groups, their incomes are very alike, and they're engaged in conflict. Okay, even then, you cannot abandon the economic hypothesis, because that's just fighting over a given cake, okay, even though it looks profoundly uneconomic. Okay? And in fact, income inequality within a group may even may increase this sort of conflict. Okay. A very good example is the buying of so-called conflict labor, right, in Gujarat in 2002, when low-caste Dalits were actually incorporated into fighting against Muslims and in the carnage, actually, against Muslims with economic inducements. And this, of course, can happen more easily when there is inequality within the group of Hindus. So the interaction of economics and ethnicity really creates new conceptual challenges, I think, for the measurement of polarization. Okay, so I'm going to end now. Okay, so I summarize. So several authors, notably Huntington, have argued for cultural explanations of economic development, or the lack thereof. Extending this line of thinking, scholars such as Horowitz have suggested links between conflict and ethnic differences. But statistical studies that use a well-known measure of ethno-linguistic fragmentation or religious fragmentation show no links with conflict, okay, though there are links with economic growth. And in this lecture, I've argued for the use of a measure very different from fragmentation, the polarization index. This measure has a philosophical foundation, which I call the identity alienation framework, which may be useful in other applications, I'm not very sure. And then I discuss an empirical study which uses this polarization measure to exhibit a robust and positive relationship between ethnic polarization and the incidence of conflict. Okay? And I want to end by saying that this does not mean that we buy Huntington. Okay, that's what I was going to say at the very end, right? We don't necessarily buy Huntington on the primordial nature of cultural differences, and economic war may still be waged behind the ethnic veil, right? So for reasons I have described, we are not in a good position to test that particular theory. So I'll stop here. Thanks.
One of the nice things about economics in the past decade is that it's been broadening its horizons across the social sciences, and tonight's talk was, I think, a wonderful illustration of that cross-social science dimension. I would like to open the floor for questions for Dobraj, and I believe Professor Bhattacharya already has his hand up.
I have two...
Wait for the mic.
Very, very, very closely interrelated question. First... gossip one, who proved theorem two? Second, why is alpha greater than two ruled out? I saw the other part, okay? And thirdly, I was also thinking about the last set of questions, but why not have y minus x in the social measure also? But you pointed out problems with that. So suppose we run a regression where we have the, without y minus x, zero or one measure for social polarization, we shove in also your economic polarization in the regressions, maybe interact the two, okay, variables. Wouldn't that give us at least a start towards thinking about the kind of measures you might want to construct for multidimensionality?
Should I answer? Okay. So very quickly, because there may be other questions, the reason why you get an upper bound on alpha is actually done, it comes about through the use of the first axiom. So when you compress globally, then identification also goes up. And the assumption states that identification should not go up so much that it swamps the alienation effect. And that creates an upper bound on alpha. Okay. You also asked who proved theorem two. We did. Okay. now, as for distances across groups and so forth, there's actually a project being run by Fearon, who's trying to calculate, as you can imagine, it's very hard, trying to sort of write down notions of socioeconomic differences across groups. But I would be careful for that, for the very last remarks that I made, that differences may actually be conflict reducing. Okay. As for economic polarization, putting an economic polarization in the regression, this is something that we've been very interested in. As you can see, this work is all very recent, and this is something that has been in our minds, and we plan to try it, but I have no results to report on that.
I have, I'll make one remark to start with, okay. That one of the things I wonder about this is that it seems not to be able to incorporate the fact that sometimes your identity is determined by other people's perceptions of you. I'm thinking about this paper on who is a J, right? It's not necessarily how one feels about oneself, but how others identify you. That doesn't seem to be incorporated in this. Could it be?
Right. So what's there really is a shorthand. So instead of thinking of income or anything, just think of a general
space of characteristics and a distribution over that space. Imagine mm-hmm. you're located somewhere in that space. The concept that's being used here is that you get your identity kick out of the number of people located in some neighborhood, in some small neighborhood around your space. Now, if one wants to open that box and go inside and see why that kick is coming, partly it may be that such people also hold you in esteem or feel mm-hmm. identity from you, and then there may be sort of a reciprocal phenomenon there, of which this is a reduced form. Mm-hmm. So I certainly agree with you is that the way I've written it down does not have all that, all those nuances in there, but it's not clear to me that it's incompatible with that. Okay. It's probably going to be the reduced form of such a problem. Mm-hmm.
Another thing that struck me, and probably did many, or I'm sure would other people, is that is a perfectly competitive economy, say, where you have much diversity, right? You have fractionalization, different tastes, different endowments, and so on, versus, say, an economy where you have a few small competing major firms, right? This seems to be in the same sort of spirit. Although, does any of the literature, do any of the ideas transfer from one setting to the other?
That's a very good question. In fact, we've thought about the industrial organization setting, for example. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I should also say that the Montalvo Marta Reynal paper ends with exactly this, that in perfectly competitive economies, one might assume that this is the analog of a highly fragmented world, right? Whereas the oligopolistic economy is not, right?
Mm-hmm.
But again, there's no literature. I mean, if there are students around who want to sort of go with any of this, you're very welcome. There is no literature on this.
Thank you.
I was just curious if in the Montalvo Reynal paper that's just come out, if they've considered the possibility of endogeneity, the idea that ethnicity is flexible, and that there may be a consolidation in your population densities due to conflict, so that there might be an endogeneity problem with their results. They may not be accounting for the impact of war in creating ethnicity as well.
That's a super question, okay? And this is a question that has bothered me. And so to answer that question, you have to figure out exactly how the data is constructed. So let's take ethnicity. So there are basically six characteristics of ethnicity, and I may not be able to list all of them, but basically race, color, language, nationality, something broadly called culture, and I don't know what I missed out. And what let's say the World Christian Encyclopedia does is that it actually tries to ask the question, what is this person's fundamental ethnic source of ethnic identity, and uses this to form a classification. Now your question is very relevant here because it raises this issue, if there is conflict and the conflict has organized itself along certain lines, then my notion of identity may be affected by the conflict and I might be starting to feel a particular way when I think so. There's also endogeneity in the notion of what an ethnic group is, right? So for this reason, Marta Reynal and Jose Montalvo, they actually use a thicker notion of ethnicity, which is to use the notion of ethno-linguistic family, which is a notion which is sort of a little wider than what the WCE uses. One could reasonably argue that it's exogenous. For example, in Sierra Leone, it would be there would be many different ethnic groups. But there would be two large ethno-linguistic families. And the endogeneity there is not as strong. However, the explanatory power of such things is also compromised to some extent, because you expect a conflict. So this is a good question and a hard one. But they have a fair amount of exogeneity because of the way they construct it.
I'm not an economist, so I might have misunderstood things, but I wondered whether the construction of ethnic groups in this theory puts them as sort of billiard balls that are very sort of distinct from each other, whereas in fact in many societies the edges of an ethnic group are very fuzzy. You might be both ethnic groups, or you might be one of three together through intermarriage and what you feel about yourself. So does this take into account that those lines are not as hard as they look in the graph?
Right. good question. The theory that I talked about does, for reasons which I'll tell you in the next few seconds, but the empirical world doesn't. It actually creates sharp dividing lines where they're really not, right? Because ethnic boundaries are always porous, right? The reason the theory actually takes it into account is because if you think of approximating the identity of a person by the density of a distribution at a particular point, then if you go away from there, the height will typically be correlated with the density a little bit far away as well. So it's not like this person and his immediate neighborhood exists in a complete vacuum. It will be correlated with also the densities in the neighborhood around that person, unless the density function really wiggles like crazy, okay? which of course in all, in most situations it does not. So definitely the overlap idea is there in the theoretical construction. But it's there with a vengeance, because in some sense I'm assuming that the sense of identification is proportional to the identity of people in a very tiny neighborhood. That's a kind of negative. So you try to pull in one direction, you push up against another sort of that. But we can talk about it in more detail.
Wanted a question about the ethno-linguistic ELF, the measure of ELF. You used it to. You mentioned at the start of your talk that the couple of papers that talked about the impact of ELF on, say, provision public goods,
right.
And to me it seems as if it can explain, conflict within institutions. Conflict doesn't actually descend into violence, and it's a sort of disagreement over the level of public goods. Has there actually been studies on the impact of ethnic polarization on, less violent measures of conflict? And, and if the results can't actually show that there is conflict on the same level, why is there a difference, between, ethnic polarization having an impact on violent conflict but not on less violent conflict?
So that's again a very, very good question. And in fact, the ELF measures seem to work much better in sort of localized spheres of conflict. For example, as you said, there's a work by Alessina and La Ferrara on public goods. There is the work on sort of effects on growth. We can think more growth or rates of growth, which we can think of really as a decentralized phenomenon, right? By Easterly and Levine and Alessina and so forth. The converse attempt to take measures of polarization to the localized data, I have not seen. Partly because I have to say, partly because this literature has been somewhat insular until, we were of course doing this ivory tower thing. When people will pick up polarization, they will. They're not going to push it, right? Which was wrong, of course. Until Martha Reynal picked this up and really has developed it, it hasn't been that much noticed in the literature. Now it's getting, of course, a lot more attention. But there has been some work. And for example, there's one paper I know on the effect of polarization on violent crime. Okay, Not social crime, social violence, but just sporadic outbursts of crime. And there they find no effect, which goes in line. So it may be that there's a general idea that in sort of dispersed, decentralized notions of conflict, polarization has not much to say. Whereas with civil wars, for example, it does. But such a result is still awaiting empirical verification.
Arthur Hussain has a question from the balcony.
Yeah, just to relate it to the questions which have been asked before, I want to ask the question of multiple identities. That is, obviously people have multiple identities, not one. But really related to that, which identity trumps others is contextual. So if we're talking about our part of the world, South Asia, people might have religious identities, caste affiliation, and obviously ethnic identities, depending on the context. The difference which drives the conflict may well be different.
That's an excellent point. And in fact, the question of group salience, okay, what cuts are salient in a particular society, is not something that this entire talk is actually designed to address. For example, in my definition of polarization, it's assumed what the basic groups are, right? And then it's trying to say what is the best way to put that together, right? Put the distribution of the population together into a measure, right? That could be applicable. But what you're asking is the sort of the next step on that research program, which I am actually currently engaged in, which is to actually build behavioral models. So imagine imagine the following situation. So let me take a situation and distill it down to a very simple a simple model. Imagine that there are people who are distinguished by income or wealth, and people who are distinguished by, let's say, two ethnic groups, right? So there's a collection of such people. And you can have two kinds of warring coalitions that form in this society. Class-based coalitions, or you can have which cut vertically, or you can have ethnic coalitions which cut horizontally. Question, what coalitions are likely to form in that society? Right? Now, this is not a question which a theory of measurement can answer. Right? This is a question which, at least if you're thinking theoretically about it, which is the kind that I'm interested in, you need a behavioral game theory model to understand when the picking, where the pickings are riper, right? Are the pickings riper horizontally or are the pickings riper vertically? And the answers may be quite counterintuitive. For example, there are arguments one can make to suggest that if income inequality is increased, horizontal conflict is going to go up. Okay? And the reason is fairly obvious once you think about it from this sort of perspective, is that once inequality increases, it may be much harder to fight the class war. There may be more of an incentive to fight it, but that's a different point, but it's much harder to fight it, and therefore you start grabbing sideways. Okay? There goes worker solidarity, there goes one sort of business attacking another, you know, that becomes the sort of warfare that one might be likely to suggest.
Now we have another from the balcony. No, wait.
There is this literature or inequality decomposition that you referred briefly. Suppose that we have a partition of the population along one particular criterion, religion, or whatever you can think of. Is an index of inequality that ignores within group disparities and focuses only on between group disparities, can it be considered an index of polarization?
The answer is no.
Why?
that's precise. The fundamental idea behind polarization is that it is a curious combination of equality and inequality, okay? And that you have to put the two together. Okay? It's not just a question of doing a decomposition. It's within the group. The whole idea is that equality within the group and inequality across groups, however groups are defined, okay, the two together positively fuel polarization. So it's polarization is a peculiar juxtaposition of local inequalities combined with global inequalities. And that's the answer to the question.
Just to come to refer back to some of the literature you refer to, Collier and Dahl, would you say these findings have an implication to the whole greed versus grievance debate in the sense that, I mean, if there was findings that show that poverty isn't related in any significant way to the incidence of sort of civil war, and if you now have these results, wouldn't that show that maybe grievance in the sense of polarization is actually maybe the strongest predictor of conflict?
That polarization is significant and per capita income is not. Right? So poverty still continues to matter. That's the first answer. The second answer is that even if poverty did not matter, the fact that you have ethnic polarization being significant in conflict still doesn't take out the possibility that this may be an horizontal economic war. There may be greed involved. So in other words, just because ethnicity matters doesn't mean that we have to subscribe to a primordial theory of ethnicity.
And we have one last question right here.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about the civil war in Colombia, because as far as I can tell, it's not really due to ethnicity at all. I wondered if you would say that it was to do with poverty mostly. You know, polarization in terms of income. From an outsider's point of view, it seems to be based more on sort of political, you know, differences on how the country should be run rather than, you know, anything that you suggested. So just wondered what you thought, really.
I'm very hesitant to say things about things I don't know much about. I do know a little bit about Colombia, and I completely agree with you that one should not take an ethnic spin on that particular case. By the way, but I will use it to say this is precisely why reading Horowitz will leave you feeling a little weak in the head, right? Because it's not because there's such a plethora of these cases, right? And some of them are obviously not ethnic; others are. And so I would push for the statistical method as a way of trying to get some handle on that problem. So, but on Colombia, I'm sorry, I'm very.
Well, I'm delighted De Barrage's students came along to tonight's lecture because it achieved both objectives of the BP lecture. First, that the BP lecture allows the economics department to host a truly wonderful lecture once a year. And secondly, that it allows the BP lecturer to be forced once in the year to wear a tie. Well done, De Barrage.